Angie for breakfast.
Hey, thanks for stopping by. This is Extra Angie for Breakfast, and I feel like this is the first podcast that I've put together that's really sort of showed you the extra that you're going to get. So if you listen to the Brekkie Show live on the radio on Triple M Southwest, it's very like good news, bright, breezy, you know, like you people are waking up, they're starting their day. You know, you can't be going and smashing them with all the bad news. You know, that's what other radio shows are for, but that's not what mine's for. It doesn't mean that I don't ignore the big issues, and it doesn't mean I don't necessarily not want to talk about them either, but I just feel like there's a time and a place to discuss things. And given that it was National Science Week this week, it was a perfect opportunity to have some really long, in-depth conversations with people who are far more intelligent than I am about all sorts of things. So I've spoken with an epidemiologist, and it's okay, I don't really know what that means either, even though people have been saying it for 18 months. She's actually one of the leading epidemiologists in the country whilst we're facing this pandemic together. So we'll find out what it is and what they do. And we'll also be able to ask and find out, you know, what she foresees over the next couple of years for us. So that's why I'm just giving you the warning. It's a bit heavier than the usual show. We still get a couple of laughs in. Also, we talked to a fellow called Malcolm Crompton, who specializes in personalization and artificial intelligence, and how the combination of those two are radicalizing people in a huge way. And I always have had an uneasy feeling about social media. This basically confirms it all. But again, I don't want to leave you feeling gross. I definitely go in and ask him about what we can do for our kids or our grandkids to make sure we don't make these same mistakes again. So that one's really interesting. It goes for about half an hour. And then I talk to Professor Rob about sex, genes, and rock and roll. And that's all about, you know, sexual selection and how that's even taking place right here, right now, with some things going on, you know, in our 2021 world. And yes, a lot of all these things do come back to the pandemic, but a lot of it is just general information. It's really interesting. So sit back, have an open mind, and let me know what you think afterwards. If you're a human that likes to ask questions of people who are more intelligent, that's what basically getting excited about science is all about for me. So on the line with me is Professor Mary Louise McLaws, and she is, well, it's a bit of a buzzword in the last 18 months, epidemiologist. It's a big word. We don't know what it means, and we don't know what you do, Professor. So please, let's start with what on earth is it that you do?
Well, first of all, epidemiology is a principle of how we look at medical diseases and the medical information around those diseases. So we try to look at cause and prevention, and we try to use study designs to try to get information that is accurate as possible. So we use lots of different things, but a lot of statistics. But you can be an all different type of epidemiologist. I mean, I look at outbreak, and when there's no outbreak, I do patient safety. So I try to use maths and study design to identify why patients are getting infection and what helps them to become safe away from hospital-acquired infection. But you can be an epidemiologist in cancer. Why are people getting it? How to stop them from getting it? What drugs work? Or you can be an epidemiologist in accidents. You're an investigator. You're trying to, in outbreak epidemiology, we try to profile. Think of us like a profiler, and using maths to help us predict and understand how the virus is moving through the community. But, you know, we do need a lot of other people in the team as well. We need social scientists, lawyers, human rights, psychologists, behaviorists. So it's not just epidemiologists. We look at one thing, and then all of those other disciplines help us to put it in a context.
I love a bit of team effort. Now, it turns out that Mary Louise has become sort of one of most Australia's recognised experts on the current situation that we find ourselves in. Can I ask you if you were surprised that we've landed back in a pandemic, Mary Louise?
You mean our third wave? Oh, I am very surprised. And I think one of the most important things about science is that scientists learn to learn fast. And you don't wait for many, many lessons to understand what you should do. But epidemiology doesn't always make decisions. There are politicians, economists, lots of reasons why states and territories may not respond as fast as the scientists would like. So as an epidemiologist, I'm very privileged to work with the World Health Organization. But even if I didn't, all you have to do is get into the internet and you can find really fantastic information from Public Health England about what they're dealing with Delta and how it moves fast and how it's so infectious. So scientists that are coming into the field and kids at school doing science are so lucky now. You've got Google and you can get into anything. I mean, you can actually get data from Public Health England to have a look at what's happening, who's getting vaccinated, who isn't, and that helps explain how Delta is picking on the unvaccinated. So, and then you can go into the USA and go to the CDC and have a look at their data and their information. And I'm surprised that we're going into this third wave because all of that information would have told leaders that this is not a variant of concern to play with or to be disrespectful to, because this is, you know, over 1,000 times more viral particles are formed in an infected person's respiratory tract, which makes them, you know, so much more infectious to everybody. And you don't even need 15 minutes to cause infection in somebody, and you don't need to be within a meter. You could be within an airspace that's poorly ventilated. So there's much science that should have been learned so that we didn't need to go into this third wave.
Ugh. So what does the next couple of years look like for us?
Can I start by telling you that what we need to do,
yes,
is to learn to be resilient, because the next couple of years are not going to be wonderful and are not going to be pre-COVID immediately. We're going to find more variants of concern and more people having vaccine breakthrough infections until we get basically 70% of the world's population vaccinated. And that's not going to happen in the next couple of years. So we know we need to be resilient. We need to take our mental health seriously. We need to find friends who you can hang out with either electronically or eventually face to face, who you can just have a great time and not think about pre-COVID, because if you do, you may go into that mourning phase of, you know, feeling very sad that we're not back to pre-COVID. We won't be back there for a few years yet.
Okay. Well, it's good to get the bare-faced facts.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I asked the question. So compared to past global pandemics, how does COVID stack up in terms of, you know, its comparability? Because last year everyone was talking about, you know, the Spanish flu and how many people that killed and all the rest of it. And I just don't think people realise the gravity of the situation all the way through. I thought they thought, oh, we'll get on to this and then it'll be over.
Well, one of the problems of trying to compare one pandemic to another is that things have changed. Population's bigger and we have people living longer with other health complications. And so when we're looking at impact, it doesn't appear to be as impactful because we have amazing medicine. We have amazing science. We've got up-and-coming vaccines and treatments. So it's very difficult to factor that in. And you know, when people say, oh, look, this is not as bad as the flu, or this is not as bad as other infections, it's because we now have medicine, science, health services. But what we need to be measuring is excess death as well. And the World Health Organization has estimated that we've underestimated death and infection by at least 10% or more, up to 20%, because there are many countries that aren't keeping up with diagnosis, and not keeping up with their death certificates, and not keeping up with or adjusting death certificates for associated deaths because they couldn't get into hospital because the health services were overrun with COVID and other chronic health couldn't be cared for. I mean, if you want an example, look at India. When people were being turned away from hospitals with COVID, and the hospitals were full of COVID, and yet there were lots of other health issues that couldn't be cared for. So I often don't like to get into comparisons because it's just too difficult. And if you're looking at the deaths from Spanish flu, that is also very difficult to tease out the impact of war on the young, because Spanish flu was happening during the war, and of course the Spanish flu looked as if it was going to derail the war effort, and of course people were being sent to the front and acquiring a Spanish flu as well. So it's very difficult to say which one's worse. You know, we've had SARS-CoV-1 in Hong Kong, Taiwan, China, Korea in 2003, and Canada. And that was contained because the borders were closed very rapidly. But of course, you were talking in Asia of just under 9,000 cases. And it looked pretty terrifying then because it's all about novelty and how fast it can be contained and how many are dying because there were absolutely no treatments at all then. And in fact, some of the treatments were experimental and had lifetime impacts on those that survived it. So I think we need to start looking at from modern science, and we've and even then that's difficult, you know, with SARS-CoV-1, Ebola. Not every country is equal in its ability to handle a particular outbreak. And remember, it is only called a pandemic when it crosses two World Health Organization regions. Certainly Ebola has devastated many parts of Africa.
Well, look, thank you so much for talking to me today and celebrating Science Week, because we've got so much to be thankful for science at the moment for. You know, we're not in a great position, but we're a hell of a lot better than we might have been. So thank you so much, and good luck over the next couple of years.
Thank you. And I just remind your listeners that it's scientists who will get us out of this, and good leadership who listen to the science and listen to the facts, and please get vaccinated. There have been hundreds and hundreds of vaccinologists, virologists and epidemiologists all assisting a very speedy delivery of vaccines, and they weren't rushed. It was only because tens of thousands of volunteers volunteered to trial the vaccines that led to us having so much choice of the vaccines to date. And please get into science. Enjoy it.
Thank
you. Life-saving.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for you and to you and all your colleagues doing the best for us in Australia. And hopefully the politicians catch up.
Yes, hopefully they listen to science.
Malcolm Crompton is joining us to talk about artificial intelligence and personalization on the internet. Hello, Malcolm. How are you?
Hello, Angie.
Can you please just describe what you do in like 5 words so we can just understand where you're at?
Angie, my job is to look after people's personal information, help companies and governments and people be safe online.
Okay. Now, what is personalization?
Personalization is part of being safe online or dangerous online. So some of personalization happens under the hood so much you don't even know it's happening, and some of it is what you do. So even the people who are listening to us on a digital radio, for example, there's a process that will already know that you're on a digital radio, not otherwise free-to-air. They will know what your device is. They will know where you are. They will know what time of day you are listening to it and a whole lot of other things. That leads to personalization of advertisements. When you go to a lot of websites, say store websites or other things, you'll be asked, what are your interests? And so you may say football, or you may say good clothes, or you may say good food. All of those things are personalizations that are used to change what happens when you put in a search term or the advertisements that you are shown or other places that guide you down the digital street.
All right. Well, I think we've all encountered some personalization in our lives, so I think we've got a handle on that. Can we talk about now what your speciality is, and that's the way that this personalization has come about, and it's ended up radicalizing a lot of people through the artificial intelligence algorithms that our social media and digital world is run by?
Certainly. And one of the things, given that it's Science Week, that I want to emphasize is how much science there is behind getting to that point, whether it's the computers that have been built for you to use and the mathematical theory behind that, or the statistics that are used and the algorithms that are used in the artificial intelligence, or even the psychology. All of it is science. So while it feels very personal, it's actually science.
Now, that's a very interesting point, because you quite often, you know, associate this radicalization and, you know, people shouting at each other on the internet as very emotional intelligence related. So to take it back to a scientific process might help us take some of the emotion out of it all.
Except that what's being done is that machines are being used to understand how you behave in order to sometimes manipulate you in ways you didn't even know were happening in order to take you to places in your mind that you wouldn't have otherwise gone. And that's where we get this theory of nudges or dark patterns from, because what is happening is that how you've behaved on the internet, literally time of day that you're searching for things, when you're active on the internet, where you live, where you work, the kind of things that you buy, how you use your device, all those sorts of things are all information that help machines understand a bit more about you, even to the point of, on a touch screen, are you a fast swiper or a slow swiper? Oh. And how does that behaviour change during the day? May say, Malcolm's fast swiping everything at the moment. Boy, he's alert. Malcolm looks like he's about to go to sleep. He's swiping right and left pretty slowly. But it's doing other things. Your device is near to your body all the time. Full stop, end of story. And it's the only device, and you'll be the only person who ever uses that device. So what that device does, where it is, and how it's used is all about you. It's used to find out where you live. It's used to find out how you travel, the places you like going to. When it stops moving for 8 hours, that's almost certainly because you've gone to bed. If another device goes to bed and stops moving very, very close by, then those two devices are probably sleeping next to each other, as are the people related to those two devices. All that's being worked out about you without you even knowing it. But how does this get used? We've got to think about how a lot of the commercial activity is driven. And it's driven by making you the product. You're getting this stuff allegedly free, but that's because they're collecting and using information about you.
Who's
and
they?
And then to come back to you. Who is they, did you say?
Yeah.
Well, it's all of the social media platforms. It's YouTube, it's Google, it's all the other search engines, Bing or even Safari, it's all of the devices, so your smart TV is watching you very closely. And especially if you've got a smart TV with a camera in it, it's watching you as much as you're watching it. Now, all those audio devices in your house which respond to a command are listening to you 24 hours a day, or it can't respond to the command. And there's no real proof that the only thing those devices is listening to and using is the commands you give. In fact, there's some evidence that a lot more listening in is going on. So how do we radicalise you with all of this? We need your attention. We need you to stay on my website for as long as possible so that I can gather as much information about you as I can and target you with as many advertisements as I can. How do I do that? I need to keep grabbing your attention. How do I do that? I send you more and more interesting stuff, and frankly, that has clearly led to radicalisation. There's a very famous article by a very clever person in the New York Times, and she pointed out that when she started setting up a new account and then started looking at vegetarian recipes, she ended up with lots of vegan recipes. When she set up another account and started being very interested in fitness apps, she started off with jogging information and ended up with marathon information. She's seen it in the political arena. She sets up a new account that is clearly mildly interested in left of center politics, the Democrats in the USA. She ends up being pushed more and more towards videos about more extreme left-wing behavior. If, on the other hand, she sets up another account that behaves as though it's interested in the Republican Party and right of center politics, she ends up with videos that push her in more and more extreme right out to extreme right-wing thinking. The algorithm's not evil. It's just been programmed to keep your attention, and the algorithm has learned that the best way of keeping your attention is to radicalise you. The problem with that is that that can then bury people in conspiracy theories, in these horrible bubbles where the only reality that they have is 24/7 stuck in chat groups and circles and videos that get more and more nasty. And by that, I don't just necessarily mean violence. I mean other forms of thinking. And the very famous one is QAnon. But there's plenty of it around. Australia doesn't have this disease yet, as badly as it obviously happened in America. But we're on the way.
Right.
There's lots from all of this.
So just to go back a little bit before we go forward into maybe how we can prevent this happening more in Australia, there's obviously people who create these algorithms that get put up onto the platform. Was this their intention? Is this the conspiracy about, privacy and our rights and, what we are allowed to do, what we're free to do or what we're free from? Or, do you think it was intentional or do you think that this is an unintended consequence of technology moving so quickly?
I don't think there's a simple answer to that. So the YouTube example that I gave and was discussed in the New York Times article was simply commercial. We just want you to be spending more time on YouTube, and this is how the algorithm discovered, because it's artificial intelligence. It wasn't told to do this. It discovered that the best way of retaining your attention was to come up with more and more extreme videos. Jeez. So the algorithm was instructed to keep your attention. The algorithm was not instructed to radicalise you. The algorithm learnt that the best way of gaining your attention was to radicalise you. So that's just a byproduct, an unfortunate byproduct of commercial intent. But there are obviously an awful lot of people who want to make use of that kind of result for more malign purposes, including the people who set up the storming of the Capitol building in the US last year. Those people weren't being commercial. They were making use of all of these processes that have been discovered and developed in the commercial arena for non-commercial purposes. It's the same thing with some of the terrorism things that we saw earlier a few years ago. So I don't think you can come up with a single simple answer to your question.
Well, I think that that's probably the best way to be in this world that is obviously driving us to extremes, as you've said. It's happening. We know it's happening. We can see it in ourselves and what we look at online, and we can obviously see it in others. And it's feeling so polarized around the world right now.
Yes. Now, there's a very famous bit of thinking that's done by a gentleman called Kahneman, K-A-H-N-P-M-A-N, I think. And he discovered the whole process of thinking fast and thinking slow. And what is interesting is that human beings are genetically programmed to be not logical. So it's actually in our genes. We're born that way. We can be trained to be careful about it, but we are actually born to jump to conclusions based on past experiences, essentially. And that is being manipulated on us. So I'm in a hurry to buy stuff or to get to this website or download this video or whatever it is. So my immediate needs are fast and I'll be presented with a simple solution, but the consequences of that could be slow. So one of the things to do is to learn how to think more slowly. And some people have made themselves the richest people in the world by doing that. So an investment firm called Berkshire Hathaway has literally trained the corporation not to behave like a human being, to behave the opposite of a human being and think long while we all, you know, behave short. So some of it is literally just the same as our driving habits and walking on the road. You know, we look to the right and we look to the left before we cross the road. We are careful before we turn the corner in our motor car. And some of it's because the law requires that, and some of it's because we want to stay alive. But we've had to be trained to be careful. And really what's happening is a lot of what's happening on the internet is making us forget to be careful. The speed with which the internet delivers us all these delicious outcomes is actually part of what's fooling us. So there's a lot of try and be conscious about what you're doing. So, for example, the bank, the telephone company, the government may actually require my true birth date, you know, because it's in the law. But why on earth does my fitness app require my true birth date? Mm. It needs an age of some sort to be helpful with some of the hints and results that they give you, but don't give it your true birth date, because you don't know whether or when that information will be stolen from the company that's running that fitness app, and you don't know what that company itself will do with that information. And those companies are already using that information for the purposes of building better apps, commercializing. Information is more valuable to the company than selling you the app and selling you the smartwatch or whatever it is.
So I think I won't be the only person in this boat who's, I was 15 when I first got my first mobile phone. It wasn't a smartphone, but that's when I got my first one. I was still in high school. And then I went backpacking. I was probably one of the last few people to backpack without a smartphone. So I traveled just with a regular old mobile phone. I know, I had to learn how to read maps and talk to people and ask for directions and the whole shebang. It was exciting. And then I came back to Australia and I was in the Northwest and my work colleague could not believe that I didn't have a smartphone. I was like, well, they're like $1,000. I've just come off backpacking. I don't have any money. I don't have any money for that. And she ended up giving me her old one when she upgraded. So I've actually never bought a new mobile phone. I've always bought secondhand ones or been given other people's rejects. But, you know, since then, you know, Facebook was a part of my life when I was traveling, but you would have to find an internet cafe, sit down, log on, pay for half an hour, half an hour's up, and then you leave. Then all of a sudden, when I was in the Northwest, I had this device. It had your work emails on your phone. You could be pinged on Facebook. Now we've got more social media. We've got Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, text messages, emails. You got Messenger. I mean, one person can contact you like 10 ways if they didn't get hold of you the first time. And I've had this growing unease about what are we doing with social media? There are no social guidelines. Sometimes it feels like we've gone back to Colosseum days and everyone just wants to see blood. And we haven't learnt any sort of social code. We feel like infants on the internet. And I see that every day with people just shouting at each other with different ideas. I see people sharing memes with facts facts on them that don't have any reference point, or you've no idea who created it or where it came from. Have we gone too far down the fast thinking route? How do we learn how to slow it down?
Yes, I think we have. And remember, because all of that stuff was free, somebody was making money out of that stuff, all of the things that you mentioned, in some other way. I repeat, if it's free, it means you're the product. Information about you is being collected in one way, and there's literally tens of thousands of companies whose sole purpose in existence is to collect and mash that information together in different ways that can be used for commercial purposes or political manipulative purposes or whatever it is. So some of it is, do I really need Facebook? Now, some of it's a trap. It's just like mainlining on any other form of drug. A lot of these things are designed also to keep your attention in other ways. Some of the psychology stuff shows that if you get feedback at an unpredictable time, in other words, quickly or slowly, and the feedback itself is unpredictable, positive or negative, it's highly addictive. It's exactly the actual brain mechanisms are the same as chemical drugs, that you become addicted to putting up something on Facebook, seeing if people like it or don't like it. You become addicted to liking and reacting to other people's stuff. You become addicted to watching how many of the things you do get good reactions and lots of reactions, and how many of the things don't, and whether that's any of the accounts that you mentioned, you know, from TikTok to Messenger to Facebook to Snap or any of the others, it's the same thing. That unpredictability is what keeps you absolutely locked on the screen. So Facebook and a lot of the other ones have some terrific utility. For example, if you've led your life on Facebook for a long time, that's probably where your diary is, and how you contact people and how you organise parties and get-togethers and all those other things that we used to be able to do in the eastern states. You're still lucky you can do it still. The problem then is, how do I get off the mainlining?
That's the bit I struggle with, because I've quite often said to people, I wouldn't be on social media if it wasn't part of my job. But I don't know if that's me thinking I'd be stronger than I am. And I wouldn't know how to go about doing it.
Yes. Because I'm such an old guy, I didn't fall into some of those traps, so that I've actually never actually been dependent on Facebook for the purposes of my diary or being in touch with people. And in fact, I'm extremely careful about how much contact I make through any of them, even LinkedIn, which is an allegedly professional platform that people use. But be warned, people get groomed on LinkedIn as well. The only difference between LinkedIn and Facebook is how people behave there. So that's almost a hint as to the answer to your question. That on LinkedIn, which is exactly the same kind of platform as Facebook, people use it mostly for professional purposes. Facebook ends up often being a lot more social. But even on LinkedIn, young people get groomed by nasty older people and so forth, and then get taken offline and horrible things happen. Yes, it has happened. So how would I extract myself from Facebook? In fact, if I'd begun to lead a large amount of my life on Facebook, I would make sure, for example, that I had a separate diary, digital diary. I would make sure that I had other channels for contacting these people, and basically do a withdrawal process that probably takes time. Or if you want to sort of bomb out, you're going to have to let people know, I'm absolutely leaving Facebook. I've got other means of getting in touch with me. Those of you who know me well will know those other means. But if you don't know how to contact me, bye-bye. But maybe that's what you've got to do if that's worrying you. Mm. Another thing to do is to set up different Facebook accounts for different parts of your life. You know, there's the public Facebook, your commercial, your professional Facebook, and there's your personal Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many questions in this space. There really is.
It's highly unregulated. And you're right, regulation shouldn't solve all of our problems, but it probably should solve some of the extremes.
Oh, well, that's it. You know, like, there's been other dangerous things that have come into the world before, you know, these algorithms and social media and this polarization. But, you know, it wasn't always at the speed. And I feel like our government system is so encumbered now. It's so big. It's so slow that it hasn't been able to keep up with technology. It hasn't been able to keep up with these changes. So let me ask you something, Malcolm.
Can I, in that regard, by the way, because I think it's very important, how many people who are listening are aware of the eSafety Commissioner run by Julie Inman Grant?
No, never heard of him.
Okay, I think the website is esafety.gov.au, and that's all about people who feel as though they're being bullied or mistreated online one way or the other. Julie is a truly remarkable regulator, and she's trying to move at internet speed on dealing with some of these issues for people who just feel it's gone too far.
Okay.
You know, and whether it's, you know, the sharing of inappropriate intimate pictures that have been taken in an intimate circumstance but should not be shared with anybody, and then, you know, the partnership breaks up and it all gets shared, or whether it's some of that horrible schoolyard digital bullying that goes on, Julie's your one. So esafety.gov.au. But what you and I can do is, the next time our fingertips are about to start yelling and screaming at somebody, or we're actually about to do a recording that's yelling and screaming at somebody, how about a little bit of self-discipline that says, should I really do that? Or should I actually read some of this stuff? Should I even be doing likes and dislikes? Should I just ignore it or delete it? Or send a message to the person that you think is inappropriate saying, I'm blocking you. Now, I think it's just like road safety. We need a safe highway, a safe car, and a safe driver.
Yeah.
And each of those levels have something to do for us.
But we still have car crashes.
Yeah, crazy people can kill themselves in very safe cars.
Yeah.
Very safe drivers can get killed in very unsafe cars.
So, Malcolm, if you were dictator of Australia for a day, you only get a day, what is it that you would pass on that day?
You know what I'd do, probably? There's all sorts of promises out there. Try and read the Facebook. I'm sorry about picking on Facebook. It's just an easy one to give an example to, but they're all the same. Try and understand what you've just consented to. It's pages and pages and pages and pages of rubbish. So the first thing I would do as dictator is require the notices that are given people to be small and finite and limited. Because they're all saying, we will collect such information about you as, we will sell the information to such people as, we will do things with the information such as. Each of those such as's is a simple example of saying we will do anything we like. And here are a couple of examples. So it's unlimited. They're giving themselves unlimited freedom, and I'd stop that. The next thing that I would do, because particularly on digital, is nobody ever checks whether the promises are kept. The assurance process, the audit process of making sure that companies and businesses and governments are doing what they say they're doing is almost non-existent. So the second thing I'd do is require some form of assurance process. And the last thing I'd do is have a strong enforcement process that is able to give people a whack. And I'll give you an example. Poor old Facebook had to sign up for a $5 billion US dollar fine for doing the wrong thing in the US. But how many days of revenue was that to Facebook?
Oh, I dread to think.
Some guy probably pulled it out of his back pocket.
Yeah.
It's SOB. So you need to think about how can these companies be hurt in a way that actually makes them think, so that they know that doing the right thing is the better thing to do, because at the moment it's the wild, wild west out there. The three W's stands for wild, wild west, not world wide web.
And then finally, so it might be, you know, too late for someone like me, you know, 32, lived basically half my life with an internet footprint now. But for our next generation, I haven't had kids yet. How do we do it better? we've been the test tube babies in this, haven't we? Like we've been the practice copy. I don't want to leave this conversation feeling hopeless. I would like you to arm me with some information about how do I do it better if I have kids.
Yes. See, you learnt by doing, but by having done, you can teach the others. So, for example, do you actually let a child touch a screen before it's of age 2 or 3? Do you let a child have a screen unsupervised before the age of 5? what do you teach the child? So just like you teach the child to, you know, wash its hands before dinner and other forms of personal hygiene, or just the same as you teach the child not to be rude to the neighbours, bringing them into digital politeness and safety is just part of the new world. And, you know, that's not one of the obligations. Well, I think it's actually probably an obligation of parenting, but it's certainly something that parents are only now beginning to grapple with, I think. So that's one thing is basically how you lead your own life and how you teach others to lead their lives, where you can do some teaching. The next thing, quite frankly, is one of the reasons why governments don't pay attention to anything is they haven't been told to. So one of the reasons why we got some do not call legislation and why we got some do not spam legislation was it reached the point where the public was sufficiently sick of it that the parliamentarians heard about it.
Right.
Nobody is telling their parliamentarians, we've had it up to the eyeballs on some of this online stuff. We want real serious action. So Julie Inman at the eSafety Commissioner, you know, has been funded by the government. She hasn't been given anywhere near enough money to do the job. But the Office of the Information Commissioner, which is also supposed to be policing in this zone, and I was the former commissioner, so when I say this with passion and insight, it's a joke. The funding of that organisation is a joke. You know, it needs to be given 10 times as much money or 100 times as much money as it's currently given to do its job. Now, these are little fig leaf regulators at the moment because they simply don't have enough money to do their job.
Right.
They need to be establishing court cases. But until we, as the voting public, tell our elected representatives this matters, they won't pay attention.
Our member for Forest is Nola Marino, and I know that, you know, while some people around here are disappointed in some areas of her work, I've had a couple of chats with her, and she is fiercely, fiercely proactive in the cyber safety space. She's in schools all the time. She wants to roll out more programs. So this will be an excellent conversation to actually send to her as well. And see what, you know, she has to say about it. Malcolm, you are a fascinating human, and I reckon I could talk to you for another couple of hours, but we've run out of time today. Is it okay if I just add you on Facebook and we can catch up again?
I open up my Facebook page is probably what they call a ghost site, if I've got one, but I don't look at it more than once every couple of months. And I very, very rarely contribute to it. So I'm probably actually a Facebook stalker.
Well, it's lucky I've got your phone number on my emails then.
That's an example. Now, jokes aside, I'm passionate about trying to help us as a nation think this through at a national level and at a personal level. And if there's anything I can do, including speaking to your elected representatives, I'd be delighted to do so. It's going to be the only way we're going to get there, step by step.
Malcolm, what a conversation. Malcolm Crompton, ladies and gentlemen, he's founder and lead privacy advisor at Information Integrity Solutions. So do your research, check him out, make sure he is who he says he is. But you've left us a lot to think about, and I think we'll all need to go and have a cup of tea now. Our whole world has been dominated by science and research recently, but let's talk to the author of a book called Sex, Genes and Rock and Roll, How Evolution Has Shaped the Modern World. His name is Professor Rob Brooks. Hello.
Hey, how are you going?
Let's talk about sex, baby. That's what we're doing, isn't it?
Absolutely, although I don't think I'll harmonise there.
That's fair enough. I shouldn't sing on the radio, but every time I do it, I say I'll never do it again, and then it happens. So let's get back to science, shall we? So what is your expertise in?
Look, I'm an evolutionary biologist. I spent the first part of my career working on small animals like guppies, little aquarium fish and crickets, and asking, you know, what's the link between sex and how long animals live? Because, you know, you spend a lot of time and energy and effort trying to find another individual or other individuals to sort of pair up with, and it actually comes at a cost. And so there's this relationship between, you know, being sexy and living a long time, and you can't have both in most organisms. Now, in humans, you kind of can and you kind of can't. You know, don't worry. Going out and meeting people isn't going to necessarily wear you out entirely, because we're a very long-lived species. But no matter what, if you have babies, if you raise a family, all of those things have a kind of a cost. They, you know, you can't have an infinite number of babies. You have to kind of make an intermediate decision. I'll have one or two and I'll invest lots in them. And all of that kind of sort of economics of energy and time and stuff is the thing that I work on most, and particularly the conflict between even a mummy and a daddy who love each other very much are still going to, you know, disagree about how often to have sex, or you know, how many babies to have, or who's going to do the hoovering this week. And those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in.
Right. Okay. So that's sort of like the basics. And that's like, you know, we kind of know that, don't we, about having kids. Mm-hmm. Like, it's definitely a sacrifice, but it's also the most, well, people tell me, I don't have any, but people tell me the most overwhelming sense of accomplishment and joy and love. Is that what's key to our humanity and our evolution? Is this idea that, you know, we pass on our genes to the next generation?
Well, what evolution has done is it's equipped us with these wonderful reward systems that sort of encourage us to do the things that our ancestors did and that made them our ancestors. Okay, so, you know, evolution doesn't ever look forward. It's a sort of backward-looking science in a way. And so what we have is we have these incredible reward systems that kind of feed back to us, you know, you're doing the right thing here, or that was the right thing to do, at least from the point of view of your genes. So, you know, why do we have sex? We have sex because it's fun. But why is it fun? Well, it's fun because the people who had that kind of fun and who managed to find partners and work, you know, with them and enjoy their time with them are the people that became our ancestors. Ah. And we have their genes, the genes that make sex fun. Same thing with parenting. Why is parenting rewarding? Well, it's bloody hard work. So you need some kind of psychological payback to make it, you know, to make it worthwhile and to make you consider ever doing it again. If you've had one kid, you'll know that, you know, at some point you would have gone, oh, my goodness, I'm never doing that again. And then suddenly you forget. Why do you forget? Because evolution's designed it that way.
Because they're cute and they do funny stuff.
Now, you can get that on the internet now, though.
Now, let's talk about the evolution. So how are we evolving at the moment as humans? Because obviously evolution takes a really long time, but in this space, you know, there's so many things with technology that I kind of, in my very, you know, non-educated observation, think kind of overrides our evolutionary biological calls.
So evolution is always happening as long as you know, individuals, whether we're talking about animals or plants or fungi or humans, as long as they're still reproducing, some individuals are going to produce more offspring and some are not. And that means that evolution is always happening. And you can go back 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years and look at what records we have of who lived and who died and who had babies and who didn't and whose babies survived and didn't. And you can see that there are differences between people, you know, in relation to those things. And that means that evolution's still happening. So one way in which evolution's always happening is, in fact, our relationship to diseases. There's lots and lots of genes that influence whether or not we get a disease really badly and die, or whether we suffer from it for the rest of our lives, or whether we actually, you know, brush it off, et cetera. So right now we've got this COVID pandemic happening. We don't know nearly enough yet about whether or not there are some sort of natural resistance. But we do know, for example, that there's a psychological resistance to taking the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Now, it's possible that the psychological traits that underpin, you know, no, I won't take the vaccine, I won't have injections, it's quite possible that those psychological traits might be kind of weeded out if this pandemic lasts for another decade or two or something like that, and that the psychological willingness to follow medical advice, to have good sanitation, to just be humble enough to admit that this is a nasty disease, those psychological traits might in fact be reinforced by natural selection. So, you know, evolution's always happening. It's just very difficult to tell what's going to happen next. We can tell what has happened in the past, though.
And something that sort of is happening now is the topic of your second book, Artificial Intimacy. And that's talking about, you know, this whole online space that we've built ourselves, virtual friends, digital lovers, and algorithmic matchmakers. Now, this must have been a minefield.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, sex is already incredibly complicated and there's all sorts of conflicts involved, and, you know, ideological issues involved. And now you have technology coming along, doing something that's, you know, somewhere between what old-fashioned matchmakers used to do, what's been happening the last 50 years with pornography, as well as, you know, completely reshaping our relationships. And so, you know, the poster children for this are the sex robots, for example. And, you know, there's this worry that we're going to end up in Westworld any minute now. Probably not going to happen for a little while. But even just things like social media is moving from just connecting you to your friends to actually interacting with you as if you are one of its friends, cultivating a relationship with you. People actually form relationships with computers very quickly, and machine learning, which is a form of artificial intelligence, is starting to mine through the conversations that people have online in order to figure out, how do I get people chatting to me? How do I get people to treat me like a friend? And you can imagine, if social media can start getting us to think of it like a very close friend, it's going to be able to sell us all sorts of stuff that we don't know.
Okay, let's finish this up with one question, Professor Rob Brooks. Are you hopeful for the future species of humans?
I am. I'm hopeful as long as we remain open and willing to change our minds. And that is a bit of a problem, obviously, with, you know, the pandemic at the moment, with climate change. We can see that people aren't necessarily willing to look at evidence and change our minds. But that's a lot of what Science Week is about, is that science isn't a collection of facts. It's not some, you know, geeky clown at the front of the class spouting factoids. What science is a process. It's a process of discovery and a process of figuring out where we were wrong in the past and having the humility to admit that and to look forward and go, okay, how can we be more right?
You know, I did say during that we'll all have to take a breather and go and have a cuppa. I reckon I'm going to go and have a whiskey myself. So thank you for stopping by and thank you for celebrating National Science Week. If you do want to know about Science Week events in your town, there are literally hundreds of events taking place with thousands of Australians virtually and in the flesh all over Australia, scienceweek.org.au. And thank you to all the scientists in whatever field you're working in, because I genuinely think you're the heroes.